Hey, everybody, welcome to this week's episode of the OIG Coffee Table. Here with Matt Kachansky, my counterpart, senior director of our payment integrity team, retired special agent in charge in the OIG and the retired Northeast UPIC director. Wade was ready to go, Matt.
He was ready to go,
and then
CNS pulled him back. As soon as he thought he was out, they just pulled him back in.
Honestly, you know, working on a government contract, it is harder to get out than it is the mob.
I know that.
Harder to get out than the mob. But, you know, but it's all right. Wade, I told him that I was going to get like a flat Stanley. Remember, you know, flat Stanley? I was going to get him like a flat Stanley, or what's the elf on a shelf? I was going to get like, you know, a Wade on a Title 18.
Yeah.
So with Wade being gone, but this is a good little bit of a diversion. For those that don't know, Matt Kachansky is a historian by education and training. What does that mean? It means that he has a useless college degree in history.
I have 8 years of cocktail party knowledge. I have 2 degrees in it. So,
yeah.
And this one is right up my alley.
My
degree was in American studies. I have a master's in American studies, mostly in popular culture. So it was studying popular culture, connecting it to the historical events around it, all of that jazz. So this Sunday in the Washington Post, I still get the newspaper.
Wait, does that mean that you spent most of your time in college and graduate school talking about television shows and its impact on pop culture on American television?
Yes. Mostly I did literature, but yes. Yes. I spent a lot of time watching television and how it was both illustrative of American society and also impactful on American society.
You know, one of the most fun classes I ever took, not to divert too far, but as an undergraduate, as a elective class, I took a film studies class called Blacks in Film, and the entire semester was on Sidney Poitier movies.
Oh,
and one of the best exposed me to what has become one of the best movies ever, which is Look Who's Coming to Dinner, and made during a time when African-American actors were just coming up, and to have an African-American actor next to a white actor on the big screen in the 60s, it was a phenomenal movie, but it was a pop culture course. I would have never seen that movie without having been in that class. I don't know if I would have made it a major, but okay. You know, what I say is Matt Kachansky, good for one step above pop culture. I digress.
So, Washington Post, which I still get hard copy. I think I'm one of two people on the street that now get the hard copy paper. Had Arts and Leisure article on the 25 cultural events that were illustrative of American society. And it talked about the Federalist Papers, films like Birth of a Nation, the rise of ragtime and jazz and all of those things that are Americana, good or bad. And it just got me thinking, what are the defining moments of healthcare fraud or program integrity in healthcare? What are some of the things that have defined how we do what we do today? So I thought it would be an interesting discussion.
Well, you know, and that list is pretty big. We sat down and we started to come up with a list of things, and we decided to keep it to just a few things. And obviously this is just us having commentary. It's not necessarily, you know, all of the things. There's been a lot of things, right? We're not talking about, for example, Supreme Court decisions and things that have shaped case law related things and all of the things out there. But I think it's important. Let's start with outside of the Medicare program being created in 1965 under LBJ. I think, you know, beyond after that, obviously the first thing that comes to mind for us was the passage of the anti-kickback statute, which in 1972 was a misdemeanor. We did look that one up. the year. We didn't look up. I knew it was a misdemeanor, but we couldn't decide. We couldn't figure out if it was before or after the passage of the IG Act, but it was before. It was originally a misdemeanor. There have been a number of different iterations of it. It was ultimately made a felony, I believe, in the 80s. It's interesting to me, though, back in the 70s to pass a statute like that when there wasn't even really necessarily a healthcare statute. And for those that don't know, the federal anti-kickback statute relative for healthcare falls under Title 42 of the Social Security Act. It does not fall under Title 18. And so there were really no healthcare fraud statutes directly up until later on when they passed in the mid-90s as part of HIPAA, the healthcare fraud statutes and things of that sort. But clearly, the anti-kickback statute is a seminal piece of the puzzle. It's interesting to me only because in the 70s, I don't think anybody would have thought about how the use of technology would be so important in proving kickback cases, right? Having cooperators and all of that. And then we get to the next one, Matt, which is the IG Act, 1978. Thankfully, the IG Act was passed, and that's what got us hopefully get the jobs that we had. But what's interesting about the IG Act is HHS, which wasn't known as HHS, it was HEW, Health, Education, and Welfare, which included the Department of Health and Department of Education. And that IG was created in 1976. So, obviously the question, which we haven't done the research on, but was there a need to have an IG for HEW before everybody else because everybody saw systemic fraud or what have you? But the IG Act becomes kind of the basis for, right, all of the other IGs were created as a result of the IG Act.
Right. Yeah, and it was HICFA, CMS now, HICFA then, had its own SIU. My first boss, Mike Cesari, was part of that. And then all those folks came over to form the original HEW OIG in the Office of Investigation. So it was interesting that it transitioned from an internal SIU to a law enforcement entity, not with law enforcement powers at that point, but with the ability to, you know, to get people charged criminally for violating, you know, the healthcare statutes or the false statements or false claims act. So that was a seminal moment in really starting to take seriously the impact that fraud, waste, and abuse was having on the healthcare.
Right. Collaterally, agencies, like, you know, for example, you know, HHS in 1995, and we've talked about this, in 1995, HHS split and became HHS and the Social Security Administration. Social Security Administration isn't a cabinet level position. They have a commissioner, but they have an IG. And I think the thing to always remember is IGs and offices of inspectors general aren't just cabinet level positions. There are, I think there are over 60 or 65 IGs. Some of them, interestingly enough, have, like, you know, four people in their office, their investigations. Some agencies that have IGs with law enforcement ability have two agents or three agents. But, you know, if you were to go through and look at the different IGs out there, the, you know, offices of inspectors general out there, you would, I think, be amazed, because some of them are going to be agencies where you're wondering who is this agency and what do they do. But the thing to always
remember, government printing office has an IG.
Yeah.
Peace Corps has an IG.
National Archives and all that. But okay. I think, you know, what's interesting to me is that what you've got to always understand, right, is that OIGs exist to ferret out fraud, waste, abuse, and be the watchdog for the money that's being stewarded, right? That's the whole point of what an OIG is supposed to do. Make sure the money that's being spent is being spent properly. The thing that's interesting that we always talk about are the yearly IG unimplemented recommendations. We know that those come out every year, and that if the agency that is being identified in that unimplemented recommendation were to implement those recommendations, you know, we know, for example, HHS OIG puts out, you know, it's billions of dollars in potential savings over the years. And so there are a lot of opportunities, and IGs are an important piece of that. The other piece, and again, not to make this a political thing, but the reason why IGs are supposed to be independent of other parts of government and not have political influence is to be an objective voice, which is what the IG Act, you know, sort of alludes to in what it says. So it is an interesting premise and why IGs are important. You can see that while the Federal Inspector General's Act was passed in 1978, it is not uncommon, right? If we want to bring this to our local and state friends, it is not uncommon to see states and municipalities and counties even having their own IGs. And whether those IGs are administrative, auditing, if there's even a law enforcement component is another story. But it, you know, I think had it not been for the passage of the IG Act, you know, who would be doing any of these fraud, waste, abuse related investigations? So,
and it all stems from the military IG, the literal inspector general, which was a military office, kind right. of got into the civilian corps, and that's why these IGs were formed.
Yeah, that's a great point. Third one for our list is the passage of HIPAA, 1996. And HIPAA, really sweeping and broad, included some criminal, some civil, some administrative language. But, you know, everybody that's, you know, on the planet in the U.S., right, we always think about HIPAA and how those protections exist. And oddly, before 1996 and the passage, none of that stuff really seemed to matter. And now HIPAA has become, you know, the big thing. There's criminal violations for HIPAA. There's civil administrative. HIPAA has now become kind of the standard operating procedure for a lot of things that didn't exist beforehand. And, you know, we kind of wonder what was going on before that. But it was clearly a lot more Wild West than it is now.
And I remember I was working with our general counsel's office on helping draft HIPAA. And the main thing for us was to get law enforcement exempt to the access to the information, because when the law was originally written, law enforcement was not going to be privy to any HIPAA information. It would right. have to be done through subpoena or court order and all that, you know. So it was, you know, only through the actions of the IG offices that we actually got access via, you know, being able to do IG subpoenas or whatever is needed to get, you know, the medical records and things like that. Absent that, HIPAA would have really hurt any efforts in enforcement.
And that's a super important point. People that may not know some of the nuances, and you know, one really important nuance is that under IG, what they call inspection authority, you could go in to a healthcare provider's office, and I'm using this term in air quotes, but you could, you know, go in and demand to see records under that inspection authority. And at HHS OIG, for example, we had a form that we used, and that form, we would bring that with us. In other words, the OI2, right? The OI2. But, you know, oftentimes what would happen is you would go to a medical office, you'd go to an office, you'd want records. You would ask if you could see the records, and the provider would say, well, no, I'm not giving them to you, or whatever, or HIPAA, I can't. And then what you would do is you had this form, which basically was a request for information, but it's cited under the IG Act, which is codified under Title V. There would be a discussion about, you know, how you were, you know, able to get these records. You know, the thing that that I was always very reluctant to use that form for anybody that was potentially not a witness. Because what you don't want is a situation where you're using an administrative authority to pursue potentially a criminal investigation. You know, if I'm doing a criminal investigation and I'm going to my subject or my target, I'm just going to go with a subpoena if I need to get those records. I'm not going to try to do something through an administrative capacity, because the request for records is really an administrative request. Now, the thing that is interesting, Matt, and I know you'll remember this when we talk about it, is failure to produce those records could have resulted in a suspension from the program, right? So theoretically, if you went to a provider's office and said, I need the records for John Smith, and the provider says, no, I'm not giving you those records, you could say to the provider, are you declining to provide this under my inspection, you know, whatever it would be. And then you go back to your office, and you could theoretically, you know, reach out to OSIG CMS and say, hey, this is what happened. And, you know, you never really saw it happen, but you theoretically, under the threat of suspension, you could. But I would always say to new agents, even experienced agents, I would say there is the premise that the provider is going to say no, because there is something known as the act of production from a Fifth Amendment perspective. I don't want to get too deep in the weeds or go askew, but if you are a wayward provider and you are committing fraud, the mere act of production could be considered an inculpatory statement and therefore could present Fifth Amendment issues. And so, you know, you don't want to get into this whole kind of pissing contest about the legal nuances. So, but suffice to say that, you know, not to go too far askew from an investigative perspective, but suffice to say that one of the really important nuances to the HIPAA laws were to have carve outs for law enforcement purposes. Otherwise, you would need to do things like get approval from the patient or a court order or something along those lines, which then creates a whole collateral bunch of time and investigative issues out there. Now, I think for those of our friends that listen and watch our podcast that are on the SIU side, and you're wondering, well, how do we get our records if we're not a law enforcement? And, you know, generally the way around it is contractual obligation. If you have a contract, one of the things that a typical commercial payer contract has in it is language where you're agreeing to be audited. You're agreeing to payment integrity. And that's how you get around any sort of HIPAA a potential piece of the puzzle. And it's a little bit of a catch-22, because if you don't agree to that as a term, as part of the, what they call the T&C, right, terms and conditions, you may not get into the network. So you're agreeing to have the program, the payment integrity people basically police you.
Yep. And it's just, you know, for us as IG or other law enforcement, we were an extension of that, because we were CMS's law enforcement agency. So we were an extension of them. They had the contract with the providers. CMS had the rights to it. So therefore we had the rights to it. That right. just had to be outlined specifically right. in HIPAA to allow right. for that.
And you'll remember that there was a very short period of time where there was a lot of talk about creating a CMS IG, and that mm-hmm. the CMS IG was really only going to be dealing with Medicare CMS things. And then there was going to be a broader HHS IG that was going to handle anything that wasn't Medicare or CMS grant related or contract related. You know, that
similar to what they did with FDA. FDA is part of HHS. They have their own Office of Criminal Investigations.
Right. Yep, exactly. And so, you know, that, you know, I think those conversations don't exist anymore. I haven't heard anything about that. And but, you know, there obviously was, because in the HHS OIG space, the healthcare fraud, waste, abuse is probably the bulk of, if not the entirety of, what some people work on. What people don't always know is that at HHS, there's over 300 programs. And so depending upon where you are in the country, you might be working on cases that are so askew from what you traditionally think. For example, people in areas where there are very large Indian health services, you could have people who spend the bulk of their day, if not their whole day, doing IHS payment integrity and fraud cases on grants, things of that sort. If you're in an area like, for example, where the CDC is, you're going to have agents who are just working at the CDC on grant and employee and timekeeping cases and things of that sort. So a lot of those things become kind of offshoots that, you know, that result from some of those different investigative areas. Next on the list for us was probably the largest change to the Medicare program that was created since the Medicare program was created, and that was the inclusion of the creation of Medicare Part D. That was in 2006, is when that took effect. And you know, that's the thing that essentially created the drug benefit program for Medicare beneficiaries. Remember, at HHS-OIG, prior to 2006, we generally did not get involved in pharmacy-related or drug diversion-related cases, because that was typically something that was done on the Medicaid side, although at HHS, we certainly had the ability to work those cases. But in 2006, when Part D came into play, we suddenly now had an interest. And with that, Matt, and you'll remember this, the collateral of all of the people that came from other agencies that did drug-related investigations, for a very short period of time, we had a little bit of an influx of people who came from traditional agencies that did traditional drug cases. I don't think a lot of those people survived working at HHS because, you know, if you spend your life out on the streets doing traditional drug cases, and now you're spending a portion of your day looking at a spreadsheet of drug diversion, there's a little bit of a disconnect. But Part D became, you know, and to this day is still, we're seeing it on the roundups. Part D is always a very large part of what goes on in payment integrity, both on the commercial and in the government laws.
Yeah, and I remember the furor in I was in D.C. You know, the battles going on to get Part D passed, and all the, you know, it was, you know, the money that was being spent, and the battles on Capitol. It was a very interesting time to be a witness to that, and then the impact that that's had on the beneficiaries is incredible. You know, being able to get their drugs through Medicare rather than going outside or paying out of pocket, the whole, you know, that impact right. of that law was phenomenal.
Well, and then you've got the collateral, was that there have been some updates, right? Because you had the donut hole, closing the donut hole. And there's, you know, obviously without, again, not, you know, being too political about things, but, you know, healthcare in this country is a very big political hotbed, and what coverage people can get, whether Medicare for All should exist, whether or not, you know, whether or not one state should have the same requirements for getting people on Medicaid that other states, what is covered, what is not covered. You know, again, it always comes down to that Medicare will cover things that Congress says it'll cover. Why are certain routine things covered, but non-routine, certain other routine things not? I always love the story, and I've never been able to corroborate or verify this, but I had always heard the story that one of the reasons why certain chiropractic services are covered, and there's only two codes that Medicare covers, and there's subluxation, right, which is everybody has them, but subluxation is the spinal column. But there was, you know, I'd always heard this story that one of the reasons go ahead, Matt, because this is, I've always heard the story, but, you know,
Wilbur Mills had a bad back. He was one of the sponsors of the act, and he was able to get that specific coverage in because he wanted the coverage. So and we were one of the few insurance carriers at that time, and that's what Medicare is, that had that coverage. And it's because right. Wilbur Mills needed his back, you know, cracked every now and then.
Yeah, it is. So, you know, sometimes these are these things that become a combination of pet projects, pork. We can call it pork. We can call it whatever we want. But yeah, it's these interesting things that kind of come into play to see it. Obviously, Part D is not a perfect plan. Medicare is not. There's no perfect plans, right? And so they all have their issues. But I do think that you know, allowing people to be able to get enrolled and get that coverage, particularly, you know, the older populations, people are on a lot of medicine as they get older, good, bad, or indifferent. And it really does have the ability to bankrupt you. You know, and we've seen a lot of cases in the Part D space in from drug diversion, but all the way through, right, the EpiPen cases that were out there. The one guy that wound up going to jail, Skrillis, I think was his name, the private equity guy or whatever, where, you know, buys a company and increases the price over 6 months or 8 months by thousands of percentage points, making drugs that are life-saving drugs almost, if not actually, unattainable by people. So, you know, there's a lot of work to do, but the Part D, I would say, 2006. And then I think the last one, at least in most recent times, And this one will be very controversial. And, you know, there's been a lot of things to look to change it or adjust it or whatever, was the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010. Now, while there are going to be a lot of things that people will argue are not good about the Affordable Care Act and a lot of the changes that have occurred, the fact is that the Affordable Care Act of 2010 was one of the largest overhauls of the American healthcare system. Good, bad, or indifferent, the creation of the exchange to give people opportunities to get healthcare in, at the very minimum, it gives people an opportunity to go on in a consolidated format and look to see what their options are. Whether you choose those options, whether you don't, whether you want to call not taking the options a penalty, a tax, whatever you want to call it, prior to the Affordable Care Act and prior to healthcare.gov, if you were looking to just get healthcare on your own, it was a challenge to just find where to go and look for it, right? So at the minimum, you have things like that. The level setting of creating kind of a level set from state to state on what the requirements are for coverage, things of that. I mean, do I think that was the Affordable Care Act is obviously not perfect. There's a lot of issues. There's an evolution. You know, if our members of Congress could ever maybe agree to agree, there could be, you know, maybe some changes. But what do you, from the Affordable Care Act, what are some of the things that you see as being, you know, what makes it for me, what makes it a seminal thing for me was the fact that people who couldn't get coverage, and it's not couldn't get coverage, but the ease of finding coverage, whether you agree with it, whether it's
facilitating the, you know, the research, but also things like, you know, the precondition, you know, having a precondition was no longer a deciding factor in whether an insurer could cover you anymore or not. Opened insurance up to people that couldn't get it before, at least at any type of a reasonable price. I mean, that was one of the good things. What I thought, you know, what I remember from ACA related to what we do is there were specific fraud, waste, and abuse provisions in the ACA, such as what CMS had to do for enrollment of providers who were, you know, there were risk models that they would score enrollees, providers, as high, medium, or low risk, and there were steps that had to be taken before enrollment,
right,
that these providers had to pass them before they became enrolled in Medicare. And I think that was a tremendous, right, boom, no, that is to fraud, that is waste, and abuse.
You know, one thing that I really like, and unfortunately, my recollection is there are really no enforcement provisions for it, and I've never seen anybody actually be called to task. But one of the nuances of the Affordable Care Act is that it requires that if you are a Medicare, Medicaid participating provider, that you must have a compliance program. You must have an effective compliance program. And so you go over, you look at the IG, you know, Office of Counsel to the Inspector General, there's definitions of what an effective compliance program is, all of that. I really would love to see in any overhaul of ACA or any additions to ACA, I would love to see that language be firmed up with some teeth. Because I do think that, you know, that's an area where providers take compliance as an option and for granted. And I know, you know, when you talk to people that are compliance professionals, you know, Sean Weiss always comes to mind. Sean Weiss is one of the premier compliance people in this country on the provider side and is a wealth of knowledge. You know, he'll come right out and tell you all the time that compliance is not an option, and the things that compliance does is help you avoid pitfalls and all of those things. I would love to see a situation where the Affordable Care Act is tweaked to put some real teeth to failing. And I'm not saying criminal, because that I think is a stretch. But I think from an administrative perspective or a civil perspective, if you don't have a compliance program in place and you get caught for something, whether it be on a QTAM, whatever it may be, that you should be held to a higher standard of accountability. Because if you did a self-disclosure, for example, then you clearly had a compliance program that identified it, right? You did something. if you get caught on a civil case and it turns out that you had no compliance program whatsoever, there should be a penalty to be paid for that, because the argument being that if you had an effective compliance program, you could have been in a place where you would have been able to identify this as a, you know, as a problem. And then theoretically, you would have been in a place where you would have been able to self-disclose or rectify this. So for me, I would love to see a, I would love to see that get some teeth. As we wrap up, Matt, closing thoughts, what would be the one tweak that you would love to see happen?
I would like to see, I think, the more funding toward the things that, that were in the fraud, waste, and abuse provisions. I think, you know, they said that they were mandatory, but they didn't give the funding to actually enforce them. And I think that's what's needed, you know, go through them, you know, the mandatory versus, you know, voluntary and choosing the insurance.
Right.
That's a political thing. But making sure that the right people are getting into the program and right providers are getting into the programs and ensuring that they have the things in place to make them act in good faith, that would be hugely important to, you know, right, reducing overall fraud, waste, and abuse by mistake or otherwise. You know, there's going to be, you know, mistakes made, but this would help resolve those.
It's a great point. Yeah, it's a great point. And we're seeing, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there about where changes are going to come and coverage and what have you. But, you know, a lot of it will always come back to, you know, what are the enforcement options that are out there? I mean, we could have gone on, our list could have been substantially longer. We could have talked about meaningful use, interoperability, the Office of the National Coordinator. We could talk about price transparency, the No Surprises Act, all of that. Because that list could really, you know, we really could have a list of 20 things. And I think one of the biggest issues is that as technology evolves, that is going to require, as anything else in government, government unfortunately is always way behind the curve on the technology piece. And so, you know, I think that any updates to the Affordable Care Act that are from that regulatory language on enforcement and making sure that providers stay within those lanes, you know, stay coloring your lines, right? You know, is going to be part of that. This list, again, I think could be great. For people that are paying attention that, you know, tune into our podcast, throw in the comments, what do you think should be some of the other things that are those seminal moments in healthcare payment integrity and healthcare fraud, waste, abuse outside of what we talked about? That list could be huge. There's case law. We could spend hours talking about the different case law, things out there.
The Civil False Claims Act case law.
Tons. Yes, yes. There's tons of it. So, you know, again, we only have a limited amount of time. We could talk about this stuff forever, those seminal moments in healthcare payment integrity and stuff. So, throw in the comments. We could certainly talk more about it as time goes on. So, you know, it's good. If Wade was here, he'd have a list of 10 more things to talk about. So it's a good thing that it was just the two of us, because we can go on for forever. But as always, Matt, good conversation. It's good to see that your history degree and your master's in history and pop culture.
American Studies.
Okay. You wrote your master's thesis on the puffy shirt.
Nope, I wrote it on advertising in American magazines from the 30s, 50s, and 80s, and how they were illustrative of what was going on in society at that time.
Yeah, you have a
cloth. Spent a lot of time at the Library of Congress going through old, like, Look magazines and doing ads. And
if you have a cough, smoke a cigarette. Doctor recommended.
Oh, good stuff.
Yeah, good stuff. Yeah. All right, buddy. Listen, it's time for us to go. Thanks for tuning into this week, and we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable.
Thank you all.